Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Dissidents and Dictators, the flagship podcast from the Human Rights Foundation. Here with me is my co-host, Mr. Casey. He appeared in the Wall Street Journal like that recently. Say hi.
That's exactly correct. I'm Mr. Casey now.
Mr. Casey forever. Today, we'll be talking to Faisal Al-Muhtar, founder of Ideas Beyond Borders and a 2024 Oslo Freedom Forum speaker. We'll discuss his firsthand experience with the villainy of extremism and authoritarianism and what's next for his home country of Iraq.
Hi, Faisal.
Hello,
welcome
hello.
To the office.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited to have you.
Thank you.
We're thrilled to have
you.
Yes. You know, when we have these podcast conversations, we love hearing the stories of the guests that we have in the office with us. And I know Alicia mentioned this in the introduction. You know, we like to start off with things maybe a little easier, maybe a little more accessible. You know, your biography on the Oslo Freedom Forum website, Faisal, which Alicia just mentioned, I'll just read it. It says you, quote, experienced the villainy of extremism and authoritarian regimes firsthand. Again, easy stuff, simple things to really get us into this conversation. I don't know where to take things from there. Faisal, it is an honor to have you here. Where are you from? How did you get into this space? What does this actually mean, the villainy of extremism and authoritarian regimes firsthand?
I will reverse it. It's the villainy of authoritarianism and then extremism. Okay. My story began first under the regime of Saddam Hussein. I was born to an academic family, I guess to a typical Middle Eastern family. My dad is a doctor, my mom is a lawyer, and all my siblings are engineers and doctors. So we
follow. Smart bunch.
And then I'm the failure here. So, my first experience with authoritarianism was that my dad, when I was 8 or 9 years old, he was telling me that everything that is said in the house, you cannot say it outside. And it was mainly he was talking about the first Gulf War when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, is that what we were taught in schools was that Israel and America invaded Iraq and we won that war. And the fact that we won that war, Saddam Hussein is still in power. And in fact, there was no mention of Kuwait at all, of all the Iraqi education systems. They can actually even go right now in middle of Iraq and ask about the invasion of Kuwait, and everybody would tell you that's a lie. We didn't actually invade Kuwait. We were invaded, and then we fought back, and we won. So that's like really my 8-year-old's experience of authoritarianism, of being told that everything that we say in the house. And then later, as I was growing up, my dad started being afraid of his friends because there was this, for those of us who grew up with authoritarianism might get it, is that there is kind of a rumor of authoritarianism is that 1 out of 4 people are in the intelligence. You don't know if it's true or not, but you have to believe it. Mm-hmm. So in a way is that you always have to think that the person you are talking to could be an intelligence service. And then you experience it is like every couple of months, like some people in the neighborhood just disappears and nobody knows where they went. Most likely they have been taken by the intelligence services, et cetera. So you're kind of in a...
It's the fear to control.
It's the fear of control. And then in a way, it gets in your head.
Yeah.
So that's when authoritarianism stops being just like a physical force to kill people or coerce people. But then it becomes just in your head, is that you start becoming afraid of your own neighbors, you're becoming afraid of that. And then, so that's kind of the first chapter. The swing chapter, the one in between, was when the U.S. invaded Iraq, or liberated, depends who you ask. So I can go in detail of kind of the ethnic divides in the country. And so that's kind of the removal of that regime, and then kind of still experiencing the back effects of it. I mean, the news starts showing up about all the mass graves that exist all across Iraq of people being killed by the tens, if not hundreds of thousands. And every couple of weeks, we discovered a mass grave in this area of these people who were killed. And however, the regime really didn't end after the war.
Right.
All of the people who were officers and in the intelligence services, and we can go more about U.S. foreign policy and and the mistakes or the non-mistakes. So many of these people who were in the intelligence services that were 1 out of 4 became part of the militias that eventually... Because it's the second chapter of my life where my neighborhood, which was predominantly Saddam supporters, turned an Al-Qaeda household.
Right. I think I want to back up for a second, though, Faisal, because you mentioned you were, 8 years old, 9 years old, when your father's having these conversations with you. So there's this awareness, even as a child, that the governing structures, the societal structures, certainly are not ideal, but there are also risks. There are clearly threats. And as you grow year after year after year, you see more of this firsthand. Was this, and again, we've talked about this with other guests before, you know, there's the personal experience, the family experience, obviously seeing what happens to your friends and your neighbors as well. Was there a moment that you can recall, obviously the conversation with your father, but maybe for you personally, when you realized this is something I'm interested in, this is something I may want to focus on eventually, this is maybe something I want to form a career around. Were there moments, were there other conversations, stories, developments in the news, obviously the U.S. invasion of Iraq being a big one that you just mentioned. Anything else that you can recall from that period?
So, yeah, so, I mean, my drive to activism was in the later chapter, which was when Al-Qaeda took over the... So I grew up in West Baghdad, and West Baghdad is mostly known because it was close to Fallujah and where the U.S. Army has suffered a lot of defeats. And so the usual, I mean, Al-Qaeda in a way gives you two choices. You either submit to them or you fight them. There is no middle ground. You cannot sing Kumbaya with Al-Qaeda. And in a way, I would say is like there's a part of me that was forced into activism. Is that, I mean, the usual, we used to have kind of a Kia bus that used to come to my home and then take me to school. Unfortunately, in many weeks, we actually have to stop by dead bodies before we actually have to be able to walk to school because Al-Qaeda used to close the streets with the, most of the Shias and other groups that they used to kill. So in a way, it's like you witness all of that. I mean, in the beginning, you get like the emotional shock is that you see it and you get terrified. But then after a while, when you get used to it, the feeling that I hated was getting used to it. And that, I would say, is the, how I say, like, that's what I start thinking. Is like, I have to do something. Yeah. And that was really in a young age. And I've written kind of in detail about something called The 5 Minutes That Changed My Life, which was really that experience of getting used to seeing people being killed, etc. The other one, which I guess expedited that piece, was the fact that I almost got kidnapped. And for a lot of reasons, go in detail. Some of it, in fact, was personal because there was a time in which they were killing all the academics. And because my parents are academics, so they were trying to either kidnap and kill anybody associated with academia. So there was, in 2007, 2008, you see lots of stories of doctors, academics being killed by these terrorist groups. And it was really by luck that, so they came in to, like, they stopped the car and they came to get me. And then by the same time, a U.S. Humvee was driving in the neighborhood. And then these guys went back to their car and they flew away. And I was kind of frozen at that time when that was happening. And really, I was like, okay, like, I have to do something. Not only that I'm experiencing those people killing people every day, now they're coming to get me. And then, I mean, there are two other attempts happened after that, but that's how I say, like, the combination of all of these factors is really what drove me to I guess, what I am today.
Few people ever have to experience an attempted kidnapping once. You've had to experience it 3 times, failed, thankfully, every single time. I imagine each and every one of those propelled you in this direction as well, confirmed this choice, this feeling, this sense on your end of right and wrong, of morality, of justice, but also how to then craft a career in activism around this. How did that transition actually happen for you?
So, I mean, slowly and gradually, I mean, when people think about, like, these militias and terrorist groups, et cetera, mostly they think of them as there are these just bad guys, and then these bad guys kill a bunch of people, and they are murderers and gangs. Mm-hmm. My experience was slightly different, is that there was an ecosystem that allowed these groups and these militias to be able to thrive in some occasions. That's why my activism and my work has not been focused on the terrorists or on the extremists, because they're in a way they're a lost cause, but the people who would sympathize with them, who would offer them homes, who would actually, well, I mean, in my case, because my neighborhood was predominantly Sunni, is that the main justification is like, well, Al-Qaeda is defending us from the Iranians. Mm-hmm. That's the usual narrative, is that, well, the Iranians are there and they want to kill everybody named Faisal and Omar and any predominantly Sunni name. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to support these guys and they are the lesser of two evil, forgetting that these two groups in a way complement each other. The Iranian militias need Al-Qaeda for them to survive and the Sunni militias need the Iranians to survive. And so my focus of activism is like, let's look at what's really allowing the environment for these bad actors to be able to gain support, to gain legitimacy from the local populations. And therefore, is like pretty much all of my work, and now we have reached about 8.6 million subscribers all across our platforms, is really focusing on the general public, because I think the solution has to come from there, and not just focusing on like all these couple bad apples. If we just take them out, suddenly we're going to live in heaven. I mean, I think it's been a proven false every time it's been tried.
Absolutely. I mean, the word you used was ecosystem. And these gangs, these militias, you know, they don't operate in a vacuum. They have these support structures. And as you said, these are just, you know, regular people, family members, whoever it might be, shopkeepers, so on and so forth, that look at, whether it's in this case Al-Qaeda, or frankly, you see this dynamic elsewhere around the world as well. Well, they're the lesser of two evils. Yeah, we don't love everything they're doing, but they're better than the alternative looking at us. Where did you find inspirations, whether in terms of organization, in terms of success stories elsewhere, or are you just kind of flying blind and trying to create these structures and obviously the organization Ideas Beyond Borders, which we'll talk about more in a moment?
Honestly, I mean, the people that I work with. I mean, one of the things that drives me to Oslo Freedom Forum and HRF and others is that this community that you see, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And some cases that exist in the local spaces, I mean, in Iraq, currently I'm part of what's called the Liberal Coalition, which is a group of parliamentarians and organizations that try to move Iraq towards a liberal democracy. And so there is a lot of amazing people that I currently work with and the people that I've worked with in the past. And sometimes, unfortunately, I've lost their lives. So it's really that I get a lot of the energy from a lot of the people that I work with. At the same time, I get a lot of inspiration from the little successes we have across this journey. Is that, yes, we have the big picture and the big vision, but as like, I always try to bring the team over, like, what can we do the next year? What can we do the next month? And try to get these little successes to get us the energy to be able to achieve the larger goal.
You said you opened some offices in Iraq. Has that been received well?
So, yeah, the answer is that, I mean, Iraq has technically two governments. And there is a government in the Kurdistan region, which is predominantly Kurdish, and there is the federal government of Iraq. The federal government is at the moment in a stage of chaos. So really, I mean, one of the things I like about Iraq, and sometimes when I miss it, because America sometimes is too organized for me. So I was like, I love the fact sometimes that I can go to the Minister of Education and you can have a Habibi and you give him a cup of tea and then he can finish your papers for you. Sometimes I definitely miss that.
That accessibility, the
Habibi route sometimes I definitely miss compared to here. Everything has to be a QR code. So I do miss that sometimes. There is a lot in the Kurdistan government, or Kurdish government called KRG. Their leadership has kind of a vision to diversify away from oil. And because of that, they want to liberalize, because they don't want to be dependent on the federal government, which is predominantly pro-Iran, to be able. So they have kind of pushed towards liberalization as a way of survival. Because every time there is a tension between them and the Iraqi federal government, the Iraqi federal government says, I'm going to cut the oil from you. Or we're going to do an inspection on audit on financial records, even though the Iraqi government is like one of the most corrupt in the world, but somehow they care about financial audits for the Kurdish government. Mm-hmm. So the northern part of the country really have been amazingly receptive to the idea. And mainly on kind of a lot of key points. One of them is obviously the education piece and for them to know more about the world. But some of it is we're working on liberalizing their economy. So we're working with the Kurdish government, for example, to make it easy to register a business, easy to be able to helping them figuring out the logistics of how they can ship products all across the world. So that's the piece they're mostly interested in, is like how can they be able to connect to the outside world, and it's a landlocked place. So figuring out the logistics and the connectivity to the world is something that I have been very passionate about. And
I'll say really quickly that Omar is bringing the Habibi environment to HRF.
Yes, shout out to our producer, Omar. Yeah. Excellent work, especially in the Habibi environment.
If you need any help, I can be your assistant here.
Faisal, I think we may have skipped past it. This is Ideas Beyond Borders.
Yes.
That we're talking. This is your organization that you started, that you still oversee. When did this begin? We have offices in the U.S., offices in Iraq as well. Where is the organization going from here? What are some of the successes? I mean, you just laid out whether it's logistics or business access, so on and so forth. Are there other successes that you found along the way?
So we always, like I always say that our mission is ceasing to exist. So in a way is that we want to empower people enough to be in a place in which they don't need us anymore. Mm-hmm. So every action that we have done over the past, so we're celebrating our 7th year anniversary next month. And the main goal is to just empower people enough to be in a place that they don't need dependency on the outside world, especially in the, I can go on a 7-hour rant about the failure of international development agencies and and the UN and all of that
stuff. That would be a long podcast episode.
And probably we need like a couple of bottles of tequila just for me to handle it. But
I'd like to hear you on a UN rant.
That's how you get the Habibi environment.
because many, Iraq unfortunately has been, I would say, a victim of the fact of creating a massive dependency on the aid system. Mm-hmm. So like you can see even Yazidis and all these minorities in which they are just being fed with no skill sets being developed, with nothing. So all of that. So in a way is that we want to break that cycle. Where are we going is exactly doing that. So anything that, so we won an award last year from Atlas Network that actually focused, it was called Kurdistan is Open for Business, that about changing the business laws and investment laws to be more, so they changed the registration of business from 3 months to 3 days. Mm-hmm. So now there's like the equivalent of like a legal Zoom in which people can fill in what their business they want to do, and then 10 emails get sent to all the ministries.
That's incredible.
For them to be able. So that's the business focus is becoming more and more really what IBB does, even though we take the claim, I think it's all verifiable, is that we are responsible for building most of Arabic Wikipedia. So we have translated roughly about 45 million words from English into Arabic. And now we're doing Farsi, Kurdish, and Pashto. So back into kind of the sustainability piece is that when we translated all of this manually translated through human labor, these languages, now the artificial intelligence is picking it up. So in that way, we don't need to translate to Arabic anymore. So what we're trying to do is that each language where we can kind of reach that threshold in which it can translate accurately, that would be where we like stop, let's move to the other language. So now our kind of main focus is Pashto in Afghanistan, which has its own challenges because unlike Arabic and Farsi, it has very little scientific vocabulary. So it's like we are hiring a couple of professors and linguists to invent words in science and because they don't exist in some of these languages. So that's really like we want to cease to exist and we want to, in the education piece, connecting people through the knowledge and then through the business pieces that supporting businesses and changing the ecosystem, business ecosystem to allow these countries to be dependent on themselves.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like HRF. Ideally, we would love to no longer exist. Ideally, we'd love to live in a world without dictatorship, without authoritarianism. We're not quite there yet, but we're certainly working toward it.
Have you considered that if you say IBB really fast, it sounds like IBB?
It does. But that is not intentional. Even though some people have mentioned it to me, but I'm not that smart. I haven't thought that through.
I was going
to
say,
take it and run with it.
Save it. Save it till the end. But you know, we have the Habibi environment, but it sounds like we also need the IBB environment.
Yeah, we do need
well.
The IBB.
I was just going to say, so we're talking about expansion of projects. We're talking about also geographic expansion in terms of Pashto and Afghanistan example. Are there any other projects moving forward or maybe even strategic expansion that you would like to see at IBB?
So, as you said, it's like, unfortunately, there are some occasions or actually research done, like for example, Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now, says that the world is getting better and these are the signs. And there are also signs of decline. So my mood really depends on between Steven Pinker, who also happens to be on my board, and whatever on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And so in terms of, I mean, hopefully we don't expand a lot because we would love to see that more countries. I'm definitely worried a lot about Pakistan. It's becoming more and more a failed state, which is a resemblance of what's happening a lot in the Middle East. And so that could be a possibility of expansion. On the business side, Lebanon right now is one of the countries that, unfortunately, the economic system really kind of collapsed. So we're already met with a couple of business leaders from there to really kind of think of brainstorm about how to reconnect the Lebanese economy into the globe and figuring out a way, because now, for example, even deposits in the bank, people cannot take away. So you cannot take, I think, more than $300 mm-hmm. from your bank right now in Lebanon. So Lebanon is possibly strategically kind of expansion on the business side. And on a positive, I guess, note, now if you go to Kurdistan region of Iraq, you see that now it is accepting immigrants. So definitely there are some good signs happening in the Middle East, that there are some of the places that used to be places of mass graves and conflict are now good enough economically or kind of safety-wise in which they accept. So like last time I visited Erbil, I saw a lot of Lebanese managers of hotels and restaurants and all of that. So it's definitely there are some places where you can definitely see a lot of in success, and there are some places, unfortunately, where there's a lot of failure.
I was going to say, let's bring things back to Iraq for a moment. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, you've written extensively on this. Obviously, there are the offices in Iraq itself. How often do you get to go back? Go back to Baghdad or back to Erbil?
So Baghdad, I cannot go because of the fact of the presence of some people who don't like us. Mm-hmm. I can't mention them by name, but maybe I'm going to save that.
That's when you know you're doing something right, though.
That's exactly right.
So, however, I try to go to Erbil twice a year.
Okay.
There is a very... One piece of it I go is emotional, another one is personal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the emotional piece is that because it's close to Baghdad, some of my high school friends come in, so mm-hmm. we did like a 12-year friends union.
Nice.
And the other one is so there's kind of an annual conference called Hitechs in which they bring in all the startups inside Kurdistan to kind of pitch to investors. And seeing that gives me a lot of hope, is that people are not just thinking in the mindset of conflict and stuff, but thinking about how they can improve their country. So that's also like both professional and personal, is like just seeing that people are like, oh, how can we create solar power and how can we do online banking and all of that stuff. So just like seeing that gives me a lot of hope. And I think is like that is the luxury we didn't have as kids, right? It's like for those of us who grew up in which our lives have been defined by war, it's very different than those who are like kind of grew up in the year 2000 in which like these kind of Al-Qaeda and all of that stuff was not kind of what they grew up under when they went to school compared to us. So like seeing that in a span of like two decades, this really gives me a lot of hope.
Well, I was going
to
ask about the younger generation that maybe was born after, you know, the 2000s, doesn't have any memory of the Gulf War, doesn't have any memory really of the American invasion. You see this dynamic at play, and it sounds like obviously there's plenty of energy, of creativity, of innovation taking place, whether it's in Iraqi Kurdistan, I imagine nationwide as well. I mean, that must give you some hope, some excitement about Iraq's future writ large.
It does. And I mean, it's kind of like that each generation, I mean, in a way, either have it better, worse or better. It's like for example, my parents and my uncles, etc., they have lived, I think, four wars in a row. Mm. So like the Iraq-Iran war, followed by the Gulf War, then the sanctions, then the second Iraq war, and then the civil war. So like they have lived all of that. And then the ISIS war, but the ISIS war was kind of predominantly in all a couple of provinces. So there is that. That's the generation before us. And then for us, it's like it was mostly the Gulf War and the Civil War, mm-hmm. and the ISIS. And then the new generation is kind of, I guess, only ISIS in some areas, which I guess is the lower threshold of this.
Whittling the numbers down, which is good.
So I think that the younger generation is luckier. I guess that's also still subjective, is that because, as I said, like growing up with authoritarianism as a physical thing, but also as a mindset. Mm-hmm. I mean, even mm-hmm. like my mom right now, right, and my parents live in the States, even like basic things, she has an amazing lack of trust of society because her entire life mm-hmm. was really defined as like, oh, this neighbor gets kidnapped.
The way you think in general.
So like mentally, because she's all her life has been in this stage of fear, in which you're afraid of your neighbors, you're afraid of your loved ones. So in a way that psychological authoritarianism, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. is declining. I can see that can create a generation that is more collaborative, that is, and that's something that connects to kind of the human rights HRF work. Is that, I mean, one of the failures of the former opposition forces was the fact that they had that psychological authoritarianism. That's why each political person was working on their own, because they're afraid of working with the other person. This other person could be part of the intelligence. And you see it now a lot with the Iranian opposition, in which they think everybody else is a part of the intelligence. Mm-hmm. And then as a result, there's no collaboration between all of these other political groups. So the kind of the newer generation, we saw it really well in the 2019 protest in Baghdad, was called the Tahrir protest. And I saw that there was lots of collaboration between younger groups, between kind of different factions. And there is kind of less of that, oh, the other people are their enemy and they work with the intelligence services, which is something you see like people born in the 40s and the 50s. So I think just getting rid of that psychological fear that the other person mm-hmm. could not be your enemy, I think is definitely put it in a path of success.
It reminds me very much of what we saw in Ukraine as well about 10 years ago, the kind of collaboration, all these different groups, obviously that was a democratic revolution back then, versus what we still see in members of the Russian opposition movement where it's fractured, there's a lack of trust, a lack of organization. And again, that works to the regime's benefit.
100%.
Because, you know, again, it's as simple as divide and conquer
just
right there.
Psychological authoritarianism is like, what a combo of words there. And I think that it's really, it is the way that, you know, they massively control people by having you do it yourself. You do the work for them, you know. But I wanted to talk about a piece that you wrote last week for the International Correspondent, because you talk about Iraq being faced with a critical choice now. And so I kind of want to talk about the future of Iraq as you see it. But in that piece, you write that Iraq must answer a pivotal question. Will it become a province or a proxy under the expanding influence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, or strive towards an independent state pursuing its own interests and sovereignty? Which way is the country leaning, do you think? Because Iran seems to, as you write, have a very strong hold, especially on religious and cultural ties and maximizing on them.
I would say it depends on the mood of the day.
between
Pinker and the front page of the news.
In the culture.
So when it comes to the North, I mean, they have figured it out. Me and my friend were having a conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I think something that's what the project we are working on to some extent is really the concept of citizenship. So one of the, like, it struck me is that, I mean, in America, there's a lot of this term national security, right? Mm-hmm. The national mm-hmm. security. And then I asked my friends, like, how many Iraqis care about the national security of Iraq? Do they even have a concept called the nation of Iraq? And that what really got exploited a lot after the U.S. invasion is that the concept of a unified citizenship start getting destroyed. And as a result, many start people getting into sectarian lines, mostly in political parties. I mean, the population still has a much stronger, sense of citizenship. So the political parties have figured out a way to divide through sectarian and ethnic ways. And as a result, the interest of Iraq just stopped being existing. It's like now, I mean, you see, for example, a lot of militias attacking the U.S. bases, mostly from the instructions of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
What benefits to Iraq do we have if we attack U.S. bases in Syria or in Jordan or whatever? So I think is that, and I think we're not, most of the time, U.S. gets the blame for a lot of mistakes of Iraq. And I think is that we as citizens and people from there have to take responsibility too, and mainly on really developing a citizenship that transcends these sectarian lines to the way that we don't get exploited by anybody, including the United States. Right. So as I mentioned, I was like, this is not a pro-America article about America should need to make Iraq the 53rd state. Is that this is Iraq to become Iraq. This is for them to develop a concept of a nation state that doesn't become exploited by whatever people who want to fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Iran and America fight each other in Iraq. Saudi and Iran fight each other in Iraq. And it's like everybody's fighting. Is that for us to not define ourselves as just becoming a battlefield.
Right.
And really we'll be like, this is our country, this is our borders, and we don't allow...
And we have respect for them.
We have respect for them. Versus, no, our Iranian interest is our interest, or our Saudi interest is ours. No, they're not. I mean, each country, Saudi is following its own interest, why don't we follow ours?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that's the thing that, I mean, one of the things that I'm discussed a lot with political leaders, and I spoke at the Iraqi parliament a couple weeks ago, was like, we are at the Iraqi parliament. Can we actually talk about the Iraq piece of the parliament?
Yeah.
Not just the parliament piece. It's just like the concept that
the
reason we're here. So I hope that ignites. And I'm hopeful about some of the political candidates in the next elections that I think push for that narrative.
But this is also one of the reasons that IBB has been so successful as well. I mean, we already talked about the kind, especially the younger generations, this collaboration, this willingness to trust beyond communities, beyond ethnicities, beyond sectarianism. You know, it's right there in the name of IBB, beyond ideas, beyond borders, and yes, national borders being one of them, but borders of community, borders of identity, and to get back to the Iraqi example, create this idea of an Iraqi nationhood, and beyond that, Iraqi, obviously, national sovereignty, national security itself. I guess I'm just reiterating what you've already said, Faisal.
And a much better accent.
Well, thank you. I don't know about that. You know, the more coffee I get, the more distinct my accent gets. But, you know, this notion again, and I wanted to say, you know, we've been talking already maybe 20, 25 minutes. I wanted to maybe get things to wrap up as well. We've talked about IBB. But just to wrap things up, maybe bring things back to other things you've been working on as well, where more folks can follow your work. Faisal, it also says, and I'll just read this from your biography again on the Oslo Freedom Forum website. You have received the President's Volunteer Service Award from U.S. President Barack Obama. You have received the Beacon Award from the Ellis Island Honors Society. And you currently serve on the Leadership Council of the World Liberty Congress. I wanted to ask about that last one, the WLC. Folks may have heard of it, may have seen it if they follow HRF's work. Again, talking about Beyond Borders, can you give us a little synopsis of what the World Liberty Congress is, what you do there, and where things are going for WLC as well?
So we just had our leadership meeting, actually, a couple of days ago. So that's really the World Liberty Congress, what I would say is the uniting all of the pro-democracy movement, the political pro-democracy movements across the world, and creating that collaboration between all of them and how can we educate each other. My favorite program there is called the Freedom Academy, in which Felix, I believe, is a former Oslo Freedom Forum speaker.
Felix Barrediaga.
He's phenomenal. Yeah. And really kind of that collaboration between what have we learned over the past decades of political movements, how can we learn from each other. So that's, I think, the practical piece, what I'm very interested in, is that there is, it's built on this concept that all of these authoritarians, if the authoritarians are united, how about those of us who are not? Mm-hmm. I am sometimes authoritarian, so as my staff might think that.
It's okay. That's how we feel about our producer as well. Yeah. That's totally fine.
So really kind of uniting these, so it's really a platform for uniting all of the pro-democracy movements in a closed society, so kind of complementary to what HRF does. And my role in it is, I'm in the Mini Leadership Council, so really connecting, from my case, connecting a lot of the, what's sometimes called the Liberal Coalition of Iraq, and into these kind of larger political movements. Kind of there is Socialist International, Liberty International, etc. But unfortunately, many of these groups have been corrupted. I mean, Socialist International is going to be started there. And so kind of this is a new institution that matches that, but with kind of a pro-democratic lens. And for the Middle East people, especially in Iraq, is that for them to learn about other experiences and learn about other folks in the region to see if there is work that we can do together. Because in a way, the Iran, whatever happens to Iran, affect us. Yeah. And whatever happens in other places in the region. So, and that's when, again, back to the Iraq war, is that it was expected that the U.S. can just mm-hmm. bring democracy in a place that nobody around it wanted, is democratic or wanted to be democratic. Mm-hmm. So in a way is that also the democracy of other nations affect us too. So if these countries become less authoritarian or become less interventionist in our cause, then that helps us too. So really getting all of these different opposition groups working with each other and really connect. And so I think this project definitely has a future. And I think it's second year now. And symbolically, it was meeting in Lithuania every year. I think because Lithuania was one of the first countries to leave the Soviet Union or something of that sort. So I think there's kind of a lot of symbolism there of Lithuania and political movements. And I was honored to ask by Leopoldo and others to join the Leadership Council and see what happens there.
Well, we're going to leave a lot of links in the show notes for this episode where folks can read more about WLC, IBB, as well as some of the articles you've written that we've talked about today as well.
But I just want to end on maybe a hopeful note, perhaps. I was strolling through your social media, and I saw that earlier this month you celebrated 11 years of being in America. Congrats.
Thank you.
And you were talking about being grateful for that. And then I looked over and I read your bio, and it said, I have a dream that one day more people will want to visit the Middle East than to escape it. So maybe, you know, I was struck by the duality of that, of, you know, seeing that last tweet of being grateful to be living in America, but knowing that you had to flee yourself the Middle East. So maybe you can comment on
that. And I was going to say, also on that, Faisal, if there's one place you would recommend people visit, outside of the major metro, outside of Baghdad, outside of Erbil, what's one place, a national park, a beautiful stroll on the beach.
When that dream is achieved.
Where should we
Inshallah.
Go?
Beirut, for sure.
I'd love to go to Beirut.
Yeah, that's where I studied English. And I've traveled a lot internationally. It remains the most beautiful place I've ever seen. And it's really that connectivity between, I mean, Lebanese like to brag a lot about their country. As an outsider, I can tell you that the idea that you can go from the mountain to the beach for 40 minutes is something amazing, and the food is amazing, and the people are great. That being said, what I do love about Erbil is that you can go from a 4,000-year-old castle to a skyscraper that was built a couple years ago, also within 20 minutes.
Wow.
So you can see the difference between cradle of civilization and the Assyrian Empire on one hand, and then you can see a new skyscraper with, I think, a McDonald's. No,
McDonald's is everywhere.
Somewhere. There's actually a fancy Mexican restaurant that opened there. So I would say Beirut and Erbil, which looks, for American listeners, it looks a lot nature-wise like Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of mountains and valleys, and so it's less what most people think of Iraq as just a desert and two rivers. So it's definitely more green and really worth visiting.
Faisal, Habibi, thank you for joining us today.
Shukran, Habibi, thank you so much.
Thank you for creating both the Habibi and the IBB environment.
You're welcome, thank you.
We'll see you in Oslo.
See you in Oslo.
The Human Rights Foundation is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that promotes and protects human rights globally, with a focus on closed societies. We promote freedom where it's most at risk, in countries ruled by authoritarian regimes.